This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. No time for a preamble. Well, except I am a bit. Because in another packed episode, we're not just celebrating the early season success of surprise EFL pace setters Reading, Lincoln City and Newport County, and many other stories behind the headlines in the Sky Bet Championship, Leagues 1 and 2, but also Black History Month with an absolute Football League legend and one of the most incredible stories in modern English football. It's the official EFL podcast. We'll talk all things Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two in the company of Leighton Orient's player coach and Sky Sports pundit Joby McEnough in a little while on this week's episode of the official EFL podcast. But we're very nearly at the end of October and of Black History Month, and we're going to celebrate it by speaking to a man who will always occupy a special place in the record books of English football. In 1982, he scored a hat-trick on his full international debut for England in a 9-0 win over Luxembourg at Wembley. He's called Dean Court and the San Siro home, and over three spells he played 503 games for Watford in all four tiers of the English Football League, scoring 186 goals, and is still the club's all-time record holder for both. The word legend is bandied about far too often in modern football, in my opinion, but not when you're introducing Luther Blissett. And I tell you what, Luther, I want to start on a positive note. The world is obviously a very different place to what it was when you started your career 45 years ago at Vicarage Road. Please tell me the situation has got a lot better for Black players these days.
I think it has. A lot of people talk about it and you would think nothing whatsoever. There's been no movement in it at all. But when I started playing, there were probably the likes of Clyde Best, Addie Coker, there were Brendan Batson, Laurie Cunningham, and it was a difficult thing to walk out on a football pitch as a Black footballer back then because of the abuse that you generally got every time you walked out to the pitch. People were very, we say, worried or just a little bit scared, I suppose, of because you look different. And people, I think, as human beings, we tend to fear something that's different rather than try and find out and get to know it. We tend to fear it first. And I think that's the position we're all in. And a lot of that came out with the abuse that they shouted at us because our skin colour was different. And it just gave them license to behave in that sort of very unhuman way.
Well, I mean, that's the tribal element of football, isn't it? But was that reflective of society at the time? Was it?
Oh, absolutely.
So it was tough to walk down the street back then?
It was. In certain areas where I lived in Wilsdon, it got a lot better. You know, there was a lot of Irish there and obviously a lot of English people there. So it was much better, but it wasn't like I know a lot of people had it a lot worse than I did. And you had the odd remark when I was growing up that you'd come across. But generally, it was only until you got to school and started to play football at different schools up and down the country that you realised how really entrenched that attitude was with the British people.
And were you in any way prepared for this walk of fire on the field? Or we just chucked in and told, there you go, son, it's your chance. Just get out there and do your stuff and left to your own devices.
It was never even spoken about to me by coaches or whatever in any game. I literally, you know, you got your boots on with your teammates and you walked out and you played the game. You had a little bit from the opposition support, the supporters, and then you got one or two players from the opposition that would be that way. But generally, your own players, any misgivings they had or whatever they thought, it was sorted out pretty much in training. They, you know, no, I don't like being called that. I won't accept it. And they got on board with it. So that made life a lot easier there. So when you went out on the pitch, it was just about doing your job and trying to block out what was being shouted, what was being said to you. The physical aspect of it was always going to be physical because that's the nature of the game. And you had to stand up to that. And you couldn't you couldn't be licking your wounds too long on the floor. You got hurt, you just give it a rub. Count to 10, got up and got on with it. And when you had the opportunity, you put your foot in and let them know that you were quite able to do so and look after yourself. So that was the biggest bout you had to face when you're on the pitch, is that one where you'd show that, you know, you were just like they could be. If you had to put your foot in and or leave your foot in, you do the same. And I think you got some sort of respect or understanding from that.
But earning your stripes basically involved putting up and shutting up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And this is what you had to go through to establish yourself in English football at the time.
I think many black players had gone through it before I did. And a lot of them didn't make it because they would face it head on and, you know, it'd be very confrontational and, you know, be in your face. And that really didn't work. You know, for me, that was the shouting at people one, and that didn't really work at all. So you had to find a different approach. And I used humour as a great way to deal with the supporters and to deal with anything when it happened, because that was showing them that, you know, at the ultimately the only way they could stop me playing was physically by doing it when we were playing football. Things they would say to me or call me names or whatever had no effect on me, because having grown up through that period, name calling and that was around all the time. But I must add something to that name calling thing, Clem, is, you know, I've picked up injuries and whatever in my career, and the injuries that I've had, you know, I've had a fractured skull, dislocated collarbone, kneecap and various other things. And the pain from all of those things, I can't remember what the pain was like now, not at all. But at the time, they were pretty dreadful. The name calling and stuff, you know, it hurt, but, you know, you put it behind you and it never leaves you, because that is an emotional and that is one of those mental things that will never go. And it's how you manage that. And for myself, I could think about the saying, you know, sticks and stone, but names do hurt. And I think this is something that a lot of people learn as you go on through your life. It does hurt. And that's what we need to stop, is people actually feel it's okay for them to say whatever they choose, because you said it back to them and they didn't like it. You know, occasionally one or two players would say to me when they've caught me late or whatever, you know, on the floor, and they say, there's more of that coming, you black so-and-so, while you're on the floor. You know, when I let them have one back, you know, I would sort of then, you know, we can keep doing this, you white so-and-so, or we can just play football. So it's just always trying to get a balance on things, and you try and not go overboard with it when you have to deal with it. You deal with it as strong as you need to at the time, because in my mind, there was no reason to do anything else. You know, I let my football and my attitude towards life and towards other people would be what would be the defining thing in what I was doing.
Was there a tipping point where your talent outshone everything else, where your legacy was building up, particularly with Watford, as we've outlined, and where acceptance was a lot easier to find, and this wasn't, the colour of your skin wasn't used as something to hammer you with?
I think the most important thing, and being a striker, which is different to Vivandis, who's a defender, you know, and I think the way this can be perceived is, as a striker, you have one of the best weapons at your disposal to shut people up or to really cause them a lot of pain without physically having to touch them. And that is to score a goal. You score a goal against their team and, you know, these bigots and whatever, it hurts them so much because they're thinking, this black so-and-so had just scored against my team, or knocked out the cup, or we've been beat because he scored the goal. And that's hard for them to take then, when they've been chatting abuse at you. So you score the goal and you smile and you celebrate the goal. And that's what I did. There was no provocation of what I was doing. I just showed them, you know, there it is, that's what I can do. And, you know, and that's how I went about it. So scoring a goal for me was a huge way of showing them that, you know, they had no power over me. The power ultimately was with me, because when I scored that goal, all eyes were on me. And I knew then that they were the ones that was in pain for that moment, because I'd just done the thing that we're out there to do, score goals. And goals, as we all know, is what playing football is all about. And that's why I love being a striker.
So what about the hat-trick on your full debut for England? Do you think that made a difference?
Oh, it would have made a massive difference to a lot of people, because as a kid, you want to play professional football. You want to go out there on that football pitch in front of all these people and play. You want to get to cup finals. You want all these honours. But the one, more than anything, is you want to represent your country. And to walk out at Wembley, which I was fortunate to do when I came on for those 10 minutes in the West Germany game, and then 2 months later for the Luxembourg game. I was able to walk out of Wembley wearing that white shirt with the three lions on it in front of 80 or more thousand people. And a thought hit me afterwards that a lot of these 80,000 people that were there, that were cheering you on, most of them, you know, come Saturday when you go and play against their club, they'll be showing abuse at you, sort of thing. But I think that went for, regardless what colour you were, that's how football was. When you put the white shirt on, you galvanised and brought people together until you put that colour of your own club back on, and then you became the enemy once more. And I think that's the beauty of when you represent your country, because it does bring people together. And for that day, for that evening, for those few hours, they're all on your side, and they all enjoy the moments and the highlights that you bring to the game. And you know, I just think that's one of the greatest things that I'm able to do, or was able to do, was to do that for so many people. And it's still one of the most proudest things I've ever done.
Have you ever, in conversations with the current generation, for example, of players, has anybody ever thanked you for the role that you played in being a pioneer in breaking down barriers? Has anybody ever acknowledged that?
No, they've never. Nobody's ever done that to my face. But I think the thing that modern players are, and I think it's modern youth and the way society is, you know, people only, and I think I was probably the same when I was playing. I was very focused on doing everything that I could for my career to further get my career moving forward. And I think these players look at it and they have not acknowledged they are unaware, I think, of what has enabled them to now be part of a football club and look around and be players there of different nationalities, players there of different religions. The cultures are all different. Whereas when I started playing, you know, there was Scottish, there was Welsh, there was Irish, there was English players. That was it. So it was all homegrown players there at the time. And now players from all over the world, and nobody gives it a second thought. Nobody gives it a second thought if you see somebody signs a black player and has spent £50 million on him. Nobody goes, I can't believe I spent £50 million. You don't get that, because what they see is a footballer, somebody that hopefully comes to their club and can contribute and to help them get success. And nobody looks at that anymore. And I think a lot of the current players need to think back and think, those guys that went through this, and there's a lot of people that went through far worse than I did. And I look at them, and people like Viv Anderson playing that first game for England, you know, the one to break the barrier initially, was amazing for me, because once he did that, I can do that. And that was the big, big thing about the statement that was made by when he did that. So a lot of current players need to sometimes just look back and look at the history of their club, their country, and how football has been, and what people have had to overcome to get to the stage where now they can go out and do what they do and earn the money that they earn, and nobody begrudges at them because of the colour of their skin. And I think that's very, very important.
So we still get sporadic incidents, but generally speaking, I'm pretty sure you'll agree with me, football now tries to self-regulate, dressing rooms yes. try to self-regulate. There's an emphasis now on education and racial bias and explaining to the wider population
yeah.
exactly how things are and what certain phrases mean, and you know, that bias that people have in society towards people that are similar to them, or
yeah.
the things they don't like or whatever. Is that the way to go?
Yes, education is always the way to go. I've done a lot of work with the Show Racism and Kick It Out and other organisations at schools and within football already to help with all of this. And one of the biggest things I found, and at schools you get this, and I think if you can educate the young people, they grow up far more knowledgeable and they understand things more, and they are the ones that ultimately eradicate this. And one of the things they always, how do you refer to? And one of the things was my skin colour. And so many of the kids wouldn't actually say the word black. They thought it was wrong. And when you think of nursery rhymes and all these things, you know, the what colour is the, what, you know, the witch, the evil witch is usually, you know, all in black and that sort of thing. And the black knight is always the bad, always the baddie. You know, all these things, the connotation with that is always the evil, the bad, the wrong, and that sort of thing. So it's quite understandable when people look at somebody of colour and that is what comes to them in first, because that's how they've been brought up. So that was one of the first things you had to overcome, was to say, no, my skin colour I'm not coloured, I'm not chocolate, I'm not this, I'm not all these different colours, these things that I try to avoid saying. The most important thing, my skin colour is black. And if I always say to the kids, if you're in any doubt, ask the question, how am I able to refer to your skin colour if I'm speaking to you? That is what you need to do. And the moment you get over that hurdle that you can actually ask that question, then, you know, you're on the way to where the education really starts to kick in, because that fear of saying the word black to somebody has gone, then it's much easier to have a conversation with them.
I mean, plenty of black players on the field. We surely need more role models in the technical area. There's only 4 black managers in the top 4 divisions at the moment. And very quickly and ultimately into the boardroom as well, and into the general structures of running our football clubs.
Absolutely. And I think one of the important things is, when I was coming through, I decided when I was very young, I wanted to coach because I felt I could bring something to the game. By that, so I started taking qualifications from I was 17, and I got my full badge by the time I'd finished coming to the end of finished playing. So that opportunity was there if the job had come up for me to do that, because I got the qualifications. But nobody had ever said to me, or I'd ever looked beyond the being a coach or the manager. And I think what needs to be had now, the conversation with a lot of the players now coming through, is there are so many other jobs that you can aspire to. And one of the biggest ones, you get some sort of business degree, business certificate or whatever, and you can do any job within a football club or any business. You know, so if you, my nephew, he has got his accountancy qualification. So I've said to him, everybody's talking about being a coach and whatever, great, but why look there only? Why don't you want to be the financial director? Why don't you want to be the chief executive? Why don't you want to be the chairman? You know, there are lots of jobs all the way through that you can aspire to, whereas the coaches and managers jobs are very, there's only one or two of those, but there are so many other jobs that you can do and work your way up the structure if that is what you want to do. So keep the remit a lot wider to what you want to do.
I hate the fact that the precious time we spend together having a conversation like this, we have to reflect on these issues, but I guess you still feel that sense of responsibility to explain what it was like to be open about what you went through and to help that education process.
Well, the thing is, we can't and should never just push history to one side. It's your history what makes you who you are, and it's same at clubs. Clubs have a history, whether it be good, bad or indifferent, and usually it covers all of these things. And you should never, ever just push that to one side, because it's the history that makes you who you are. Hopefully you've learned from a lot of things that haven't been good, and you've improved things and made your club a certain way. And certain people that have come through the club, players or managers, coaches, chairman or whatever, have all done amazing things to get clubs to where they are in their little way as they go along. So it's important that we acknowledge the history of where we've come from, the good times and the bad times and the indifferent times. We need to understand all of these things, because that helps us to be better going forward. And hopefully a lot of the mistakes of the past we won't make as we go on. But if we just think that history is something just to go and read about, no, it is what helps to guide us. And that is more to the point what, you know, when you think of players that have gone through football clubs and moved on maybe to elsewhere, and your chairman, your chief executives and whatever, they've all contributed something, and that should always be acknowledged in the right way. Because yes, it may not have been the most successful period of the clubs, but I don't know anybody, or too many people, I suppose, that set out to ruin a football club when they took it over. There's very few of those. Most people want to leave a bit of a legacy to say that I did this. And you do that because the next people that come on says, that is where I want to pick up the baton from and build on top of that. No different to what's happened with players that have come before myself. We've all built on the fact that they've broken that glass ceiling, and we've all built on that. And so now nobody thinks twice about it. And that's, I think that's the same thing that would happen to management and, you know, all levels of football and all levels of business.
Luther, I'm really sorry about a big chunk of the subject matter of this discussion, but thanks for allowing us to celebrate.
Clem, it's important that this topic is spoken about all the time, not only in Black History Month. We do it once a year, And it's something that should be discussed all the time because it's a very important subject. I've discovered things in this past, since we've been in this pandemic, of players, people that have managed, of colour, have managed, whether it be in rugby or whether it be in football, whatever, in this country, which I knew nothing about. And that's why history is very important, so we understand where we've come from and what we've had to go through. You had this thing where people want to tear down statues and rename streets and all that sort of thing. Now, for me, that is completely wrong. History is important because we look at it and say, why did that happen? Why was this person, you know, in the time that they were? And again, we've got to look at the time when these things happened, when it was slavery and all that sort of thing, why these people did what they did, because it was a norm. Not say it was right, it was a norm. And we have to put things in, you know, look at within the context of when they happened and what the world and the life was like. And I think we sometimes sit here now and judge things that have gone in the past, which is not absolutely right, because that's like hindsight. And hindsight, you're never wrong. Well, shouldn't be anyway.
Luther, thanks for sharing. And thanks for all your magnificent achievements on the field.
Thank you. It's been brilliant. I've loved my career, you know, and when I think back and I think I am the record goal scorer, record appearance maker at Watford Football Club. And if I add to that being probably the only player there that's won the Golden Boot while at Watford, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've been very, very fortunate, you know, so I'm just pleased that these things have been done that will say to everybody else come along behind, I can achieve that, and hopefully I can go one better and be even better than that. Because that's what we always want. You know, human evolution is that you want to be better than what's gone before.
Thanks, Luther.
Pleasure.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Time to talk about, I think, one of the most remarkable stories in English football from the past quarter of a century. Next Tuesday, the 3rd of November 2020, is a date that many fans of Wimbledon have waited nearly three decades for. The first game at the new Plough Lane Stadium. It was back in 1991 that the original club departed the original Plough Lane to groundshare at Selhurst Park as their ownership problems took hold. In 2001, when the club itself was given permission to move to Milton Keynes, AFC Wimbledon were founded by a section of supporters. Ivor Heller was one of the key movers behind the formation of the new club and has been there ever since through six promotions and now, remarkably, the return to Plough Lane. And you know I'm a tell-me-how-you-feel kind of man, Ivor. What sort of emotions are flowing through you with a few days to go?
Panic. Panic's the big one. No, that's not true. We're very calm. The feet underneath the water are going very fast. The emotions, it's every emotion known to man for me, to be honest with you, because I'm so overjoyed, and I got the pleasure of writing the programme notes in for last night's game against Blackpool, and in it I've actually used the phrasing, and the way to put it is we're coming out of the wilderness. You know, it's biblical in my terms. Yeah, you know, we're coming out of the wilderness. 30 years we've been in that wilderness. The only trouble is, it's tinged with a huge sadness because we're coming out of the wilderness, and in typical Wimbledon style, we have to try and do it in the middle of a bloody pandemic. You know, I mean, yeah, we've had every hurdle you could possibly have put in our way. No other team has ever been franchised anywhere in this country. Until us, and then, you know, we have to fight our way to start again. Not only do we start, when we did that, people said, you're mad, fans can't run a football club and everything, and we're like, well, actually, let's see what we can do. We did that, and then we stated a year into our business that we wanted to get back in the Football League, and we gave ourselves a whole 10 years to do it. And from the date we stated that, we did it in 8 years. So, you know, and people said we were mad again. And then when the spectre of Plough Lane started to come along, everyone said, now you've really lost the plot. You know, you lot have lost it. How could you ever put a deal like that together? And then through many, many people doing many, many stupid things and brilliant things and being very clever, we've actually found our way back to the promised land. And now, so we're out of the wilderness, but but everyone's locked out of the gates, can't come in. It's just incredible.
Except, I suppose, there's a point in life where we can't worry about the things we can't control. It's not like you are personally or the club itself is being struck down. It's something that's affecting the whole world. And I guess, like many other things, we've all kind of got to get on with it. I've got to ask you, because there have been so many important characters, so many important moments along the way, but did you personally at ever point lose faith that this completion would be achieved?
Never. Not for one second, no. No, that, categorically, I can safely say that I was always 100% convinced that we would be able to get back to Merton, getting back to Plough Lane. Once that became a reality, which really started around 2008 with this most ridiculous plan. I mean, the plan was ridiculous. I mean, it involved getting someone elected to be leader of the council who happened to be a Labour councillor. We needed him to be the leader of the council. And in 2010, this brilliant man, Stephen Allen British, actually managed to get himself elected, one of only two councils that swapped from Tory to Labour that year. And he was the man that set everything in motion. It's a great story. He managed to get us into the long-term development framework, where he snuck it in there that when the Greyhound track was going to be redeveloped, which it clearly was all those years ago, that it should be redeveloped for sports intensification, specifically a stadium for AFC Wimbledon. Yeah, that was amazing that he did that.
Wow. I mean, it's just remarkable vision that you had that kind of long-term strategy and framework and looked that far down the line, because I think it would be just easy to see the hand-to-mouth football stuff, wouldn't it? Which is get out of the division that you start in, try and get to the next one, look at the football resources. But you were always one step ahead of the game. That's what it feels like, Ivor, anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you know, luckily we've got some very clever people that are much cleverer than me. You know, I've just got the blind faith and the determination, and I'm a great rabble rouser one way and another. You know, because you need all of those things, but you need brains behind the operation. And you know, there was a dynamism between us and the whole of the fan base. You know, we mustn't underplay just what the fans have actually done to bring our club, our whole club, back to Wimbledon. It's been totally absurd.
It really has. I have to say as well, as much as the club story is ripe for a film script, so is your own life, because the sacrifices and the consumption of you. I mean, I think it's fair to say, Ivor, it's taken its toll on you.
Well, 6'2" when it all started. You know that. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, just to say it's taken a toll. Yeah, there's... lots of people have made lots of sacrifices for this club.
Mate, you have. I mean, it's cost you a pretty big business. It's cost you the home you lived in. It's cost you your previous relationship, your marriage.
Well, I don't put that down to the football club, to be honest with you. I put it down to myself. I make my choices. I make my choices, and I chose to do these things. So I don't blame anybody for that whatsoever, other than me being, some would say, a romantic fool, and some would say that you know, I did it all with very open eyes. I knew what I was doing, and some would say that was totally irresponsible, and I would agree with them. It was irresponsible at the time, but what the hell? Look at us now.
but the whole vision just consumed you. It became the embodiment of your life, what you wanted to do with your time, what you wanted to achieve. It drove you every day to get out of bed.
Yeah, 100%. There is no doubt about that. You know, I mean, who wouldn't rather work on the football club that they love than go and work in their boring print business? You know, let's face it. You know, I'm not saying it was right. I'm not saying that what I did was right. It's not right for everybody, because, but I was like that. But it was a combination of everything, really. But you know, I made some very bad decisions along the way, and I hold my hands up. You know, I didn't do it on purpose, but I did it. But a lot of that was done because I wasn't concentrating on everything that I should have been concentrating on. So.
250 metres from the old ground, initial capacity 9,300, but could be expanded eventually to 20,000. Am I in the ballpark?
The planning permission is for 20,000. Okay. So the plan is that one day somehow by hook or by crook, the same way as we've got a 9,300 seat stadium, we will have a 20,000 seat stadium there, and you know, and then we'll you know, the most important thing is that yes, we're home, but B, that the club is going forward. You have to have momentum in a football club, particularly when you've got no one sitting there signing checks. Of course, if there's a very wealthy philanthropist out there that wants to spend an awful lot of money with us, they'd be very welcome. They're not getting the club for it.
Yeah, can I just be absolutely clear about this then? So financially, have you badly stretched yourselves to make all this happen? Obviously, we've got the pandemic in the middle of it. And also ownership-wise, still completely fan-owned. Nobody's there behind the scenes with a big chunk of the club that we don't know about?
No, we always had 25% of the club up for sale. And we've had some fantastic schemes to create our PLC. We've sold a lot of those shares have been sold. They don't give you any power whatsoever. So you can buy the Don's Trust membership for £25 and you've got as much say as someone that's put £2.5 million in. Yeah, literally, that is absolutely true. And it's really important that we keep that status quo the way it is, but we have to find ways to embrace investment and to embrace a scheme that will take us forward so this club keeps evolving as opposed to stagnates. You know, we've got more glass ceilings to punch through yet. We're not finished yet. So no one's going to tell me where to draw the line on my dreams or this club's dreams, because they are limitless. And yeah, we're going to go down sometime. We'll get promoted again sometime. But whatever it is, we've got our club.
Either to those that might have fallen on difficult times, to those that might find themselves now in a similar position to the one that you did two decades ago, what would your message be?
First of all, always have hope, always have grim determination, and most of all, find people that are prepared to lead and lead in a loud and proud way, because your football club is a business. It needs to be run like a business, but it needs to be run with passion.
Ivor Heller, to you, to Chris Stewart, to Eric Samuelson, to everybody that's played their part, many congratulations on your magnificent achievement.
Thank you, Clem. I really appreciate that.
This is the official EFL podcast.
He won't thank me for the first line of this introduction, but he's 38. He's still going strong as player coach at Leyton Orient. He's an insightful presence on Sky Sports coverage of the EFL. He also played for West Ham United, Cardiff City, Crystal Palace, Watford, Reading and Stevenage. But Joby McEnough knows only too well about the original Wimbledon's demise that led to Ivor Heller, who we've just heard, devoting two decades of his life to AFC Wimbledon's rise, because Joby was one of a cluster of very promising players who found themselves trekking up the M1 for home games to play for the original Wimbledon. And I've been looking through my diaries, Joby, and that was the first day we ever met. It was the 27th of September, 2003. There was you, there was Michael Ledgerwood, there was Adam Nolan, Nigel Riacocca, Pat Adjaman. I mean, that was actually some team, but it must have been a very confusing time for lots of young players with all that stuff going around and finding yourself supplanted from London up to Buckinghamshire.
Yeah, it was a real strange time, certainly for us as young pros. We'd come through the system, obviously through the youth team at Wimbledon, and South London was very much our home, all we'd sort of known since the age of 11, 12, really, since we were in the academy. We'd always go up to Roehampton and play our training games there, and obviously the stadium was situated in South London. So, yeah, once we kind of got the confirmation that the Milton Keynes thing was happening, it was strange. It was quite hard to get our heads around changing venues mid-season. You know, we'd go up and you know, play our games at the hockey stadium. Of course, with all the upheaval going on off the pitch, it definitely had an impact. And you know, for us as young players, you know, we were there to play football. We were all obviously buzzing to be around each other, you know, not just colleagues but genuine friends that, you know, had come through that system together, and obviously just trying to do our best. And I think at that time, we probably didn't have a full picture of everything that was going on. You know, clearly we understood that, you know, there was a lot of disappointment from the Wimbledon fans, of course. And that was kind of mixed with a lot of excitement from the MK side. So we were almost caught in the middle of it all, really. And ultimately, our job was to go and try and do our job on the pitch. But it was a real shame, really, because as you touched on, we had a real good crop of players there, you know, real fantastic group. And Wimbledon was known as a team that would produce players and give them opportunities. And, you know, when you look at the talent that came through at that time, you know, it's a real shame that that talent was really stripped away and, you know, the club wasn't able to benefit from it fully, really.
Now, listen, I let you off lightly when I was introducing you because you are, of course, about to be 39. But I've got to ask you, I mean, Leagues 1 and 2, Charlie Daniels, 34, makes his debut for Shrewsbury over the last week. We've got Wes Houlihan at 38 at Cambridge, obviously. Ian Henderson's moved to Salford, 35. James Purchase is playing at Mansfield, 35. What's going on, mate?
We were just written off, you know, too early for too long, Clem. I think, you know, there's a lot behind it. I do honestly think, again, going back to my time at Wimbledon when I first came through and got in the first team, it is chalk and cheese now in terms of, one, how players live. You know, you do have to look after yourselves, you know, whether that's diet stuff, whether that's recovery. You know, lifestyle in general away from the pitch, you know, has, you know, improved significantly. And I think if you are serious about playing long into your 30s, that is something that you have to really get on board with. And I was able to do that quite early on in my career. I think it would have been difficult for players, you know, in maybe their late 20s, early 30s to make that big adjustment. So I certainly think that's a big factor behind it, the sports science side of things. And it, you know, it's great to see, you know, I would be at my age, but I'm a big advocate of senior pros in dressing rooms. You know, of course they've got to do their job on the pitch, and you know, I don't think players want to just be around for the sake of it, but I do feel, you know, there's a big area that has gone out of the game, you know, the last sort of 5-10 years, and a lot of it's to do with the business side of things now. You know, a lot of 30 plus year olds are probably looked at as, you know, they've got no selling value, no value in terms of a market value. And sometimes that can easily get pushed out of football clubs when really the value in those senior players is, you know, the culture, you know, their work ethic, you know, good habits that they can pass on to younger players, and that experience that, you know, really can be, you know, massive for younger boys coming through. And I know we've touched on Wimbledon already, but so much of my career is down to that period of time. And I had some brilliant senior pros around at that time. You know, I could go through a whole list of players that went out of their way to help us as young boys. And that's certainly something that I've always tried to do. And again, it's great to see. You know, I just think, you know, you have to have a bit of luck, of course. But if you do look after yourselves, you know, you can play that little bit longer and, you know, enjoy the game well into your 30s, as I am doing at the moment.
You haven't changed a bit in those 17 years that I've known you. Let's take a quick whistle stop around the EFL's three divisions. In the Championship, Reading's spectacular start continues. They haven't been behind for a single second this season, and they've opened up their sizeable gap at the top, despite having the fewest shots in the division. It's 4 goals in 2 games for Blackburn Rovers' Adam Armstrong. It's 8-6 for Brentford's Ivan Toney as they continue their golden boot tussle. A first win for Barnsley as new head coach Valerie and Ishmael took his bow in the dugout, and a first point after 7 consecutive defeats for Wickham Wanderers. I mean, listen, Joby, you were the captain of Reading the last time they made it into the Premier League. Are you surprised? It's unbelievable.
Very much so. Again, obviously a club that I take a great deal of interest in. Had some great times there, and been really disappointed the last couple of years, really sort of flirting with relegation. They should certainly be doing a lot better than they have done. And it was a punt. I don't think anyone else can say any different. You know, a pretty unknown manager, coach, you know, coming in. But, you know, the start could not have gone any better. You know, the boys have said it's, you know, really refreshing. The training sessions, they're all really enjoying. It's got real young. They got rid of quite a few senior players. Again, something we touched on earlier. He's got a lot of energy in there, vibrancy. You know, good experience at the heart of that defence with Liam Moore and Morrison. Yeah. And then obviously the two boys in front that are really giving them that protection. And then going forward, you know, the goals are flowing with Lucas Shaw and Mate. So at the moment, you know, I think they're exceeding expectations. There will be a little dip, I'm sure. But, you know, from their point of view, they'll be looking to continue what has been a sensational start to the season.
So did that end when Barnsley appoint Valerian Ismail, former Crystal Palace defender briefly, former head coach of Wolfsburg, has also worked in Greece and in Austria. Should we be more respectful of people who do think outside the box and do look in markets that perhaps the vast majority of us don't know?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think with Barnsley in particular, it is a route they have gone down before. I mean, Gerhard Struber was fairly unknown before he came, and obviously miraculous escape, you know, to get them out of trouble. He's obviously moved on. So it's a formula that they've used before, and clearly they're confident in it. I think one thing, again, in this country, we obsess about maybe people working in England, you know, and, you know, football is very much a global game. You know, European leagues are very good. They've got a good system, particularly over in Germany with young coaches that, you know, do their work in either academies, and then there's a pathway through, whether it be in a second team, like Ismail's worked in. So he's still cutting his teeth, although it's not a level that many people over here may not be too familiar with. He's still doing that job as a manager, even of a second team. That's picking players, you know, deciding what formations to work, dealing with, you know, the management side of playing. And again, he's been doing it a long time now. So I think we do have to be respectful. I think we have to be open to people doing things slightly differently. You know, we've seen it for a long time in this country, maybe a lot of the same managers getting similar jobs over and over again. You know, and I'm certainly one for giving young coaches, managers an opportunity to go in, and, you know, they've had a really decent start so far. So it could be a way that people look and think a little bit outside the box. I think as long as you're open to it, you know, there's no reason why it can't work for that particular club.
And Briggs, new ideas and new invigoration to the English leagues. Looking ahead to this weekend then, Friday night game is Reading's trip to Coventry, 12:30 Saturday lunchtime. Bristol City against Norwich. Barnsley entertain Watford. Bournemouth at home to Derby, and Swansea entertain Blackburn. In League One, Hull slip up at home to Peterborough, and a second successive defeat for Ipswich last weekend allowed Lincoln City to go top. All three of them won in midweek. Sunderland suffered their heaviest defeat for over a year to lose their unbeaten record, and Charlton won their fourth game in a row and haven't conceded for 7.5 hours. And this, to me, at Charlton feels like Lee Bowyer once again proving his worth. I felt desperately sorry for him after all his hard work the season before last when he got them promoted, that all those ownership wrangles and transfer embargoes undermined him. And here we are. Give him a level playing field, let him do his job, and he produces a run of form like that.
That's all you can ask for. As a manager, as a player, you know, all you want to do is be given an opportunity, as you say, on a level playing field, you know, to go out and get results, to play your best football, whatever the angle is. And I think with Lee Bowyer, it's very, very hard to judge him on the back of last year. You know, they made a great fight of trying to stay up in really difficult circumstances. And again, for someone who's been at clubs with off-field issues, it doesn't take long to filter down to the dressing room, to the playing staff, and then out onto the pitch and have a negative impact on results. So, you know, I think, again, he got him promoted the first time round, you know, and I think there's no reason, you know, still got some good quality in there, likes of Johnny Williams, you know, really good little players there that, you know, are very, very comfortable at this level. And I certainly see them, you know, really putting together a run of results and form that will at least get them in those playoff places. And, you know, they're certainly a team to watch now that the off-field situation has been resolved.
And should we marvel at Lincoln being where they are, in so much as when you look at how far the Cowleys stretched them from mid-table National League, getting them all the way to leaving them in the upper echelons of League One, for Michael Appleton to kind of reinvent them and go again, I mean, that feels like a man who's doing a very good job.
Yeah, no doubt. And I'm sure he'll be looking at it as a, you know, a fantastic opportunity after, you know, a couple of spells that didn't quite go the way that, you know, he would have liked to have gone. And, you know, at the end of the day, in terms of what the Cowleys did, they've given that club a real platform to build on, you know, establish them, you know, very much now, you know, up in League One where they are. And it's a good opportunity, again, for Michael Appleton to go in and put his own stamp on things, which he has done, you know, certainly playing a different brand of football, shall we say, to what the Cowleys were there. But, you know, none less so in terms of getting results. And, you know, from my point of view, he's doing a fine job there. And again, another team that, you know, will really fancy their chances this year if they can maintain that form.
Yeah, and all hail the board as well for being willing to entertain a reinvention after a period of successive success. Lincoln City then away at Doncaster, Ipswich Entertain Crewe. It's Hull who visit Swindon, COVID permitting. Swindon managed to get through, and there is that small matter of MK Dons against Wimbledon. Newport County and Cambridge United in League Two continue their best ever opening season runs. It was Cambridge who ended Walsall's unbeaten start. Barrow finally got their first league win since 1972 at the expense of Mansfield Town, who along with Southend are still looking for theirs. Mansfield subsequently sacked Graham Coughlan. Never gone even eight games, let alone nine, without getting a win from the start of a season. I mean, and then when you lose at home quite heavily, I mean, I'm afraid I'm getting so gnarly and long in the tooth, Joby, that I can recognise, unfortunately, when a manager's about to go before. I actually went looking for the statement before it was actually broken because I thought, this don't look good. Sad, yeah. Isn't it? But you have to put 3 points in the bag every so often, even if you're building for the long term.
Yeah, I think Mansfield, you know, with their budget, which is certainly one of the better ones in the league, there's an expectation there. You know, if you're given the resources like we spoke about with Lee Bowyer, you know, you're given the chance to go and do your job. You have to go and do it. That's the nature of the game we're in. You know, we played Mansfield early in the season. They're actually pretty bright, pretty lively, probably should have won. We scored two late goals, and that's probably just summed them up a little bit, you know, this season, where they just haven't quite been able to get over the line, and that starts snowballing, and the poor form continues, and you can't see a win coming. So I'm sure, being so early in the season, they still have ambitions, you know, they still have goals to achieve, and maybe that decision is based on that, given whoever comes in next the most time possible to try and turn things around and get them certainly a lot higher up the other end of the table than they are now.
Are you ultimately heading to being a manager? I have to say, you are a brilliant, brilliant pundit, so you'd be a loss to that side of things. But, you know, are you heading ultimately for management, do you think?
At the moment, I'm sort of keeping everything on the table. I'm doing my coaching badges. It's something I really do enjoy. I've been very fortunate with the media and punditry side in terms of, you know, getting involved in that. And again, something I really, really enjoy, and been fortunate to do as much as I can late in order. I've been very understanding. You know, that was obviously a conversation that we had prior to me to re-signing. And you know, they're really happy with me cracking on with that as well. So, you know, at the end of the day, we've seen a lot of lads finish. You know, I'm fortunate, I've known it's coming at some point, because clearly of my age, you know.
Well, you clearly don't know it's coming. You just keep going and going and going. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we're having this conversation in another 17 years' time. Yeah, and 63 is the age of our next guest.
Yeah, mate. Yeah. So no, I'm just really just trying to do as much as I can. You know, I'm loving playing this year. I missed a lot of football last year through injury. Once I got that sorted, I wasn't sure whether I'd get over that. So I'm really just enjoying being back out on the pitch this year. And, you know, if this is to be my last year, then, you know, I'm at least happy to be finishing off on the pitch rather than the treatment table. And, you know, we'll see what comes next, really. But it's just all about giving myself some options. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate. I can sort of juggle a few things at the moment, and it's going all right.
This coming weekend in League Two, it's Newport who entertain Harrogate. Cambridge visit Crawley. It's fifth against third as Cheltenham entertain Forest Green. And Leighton Orient entertain Bolton. And I want you to be careful in answering this question, because I don't want you to do Ian Evatt's team talk for him. But he did use the phrase man up on describing a mistake from Billy Crellin, his on-loan goalkeeper. He later apologised and said his terminology was gawky and he should have said step up. I mean, when you heard that, did you think, not sure you can use that language in the dressing room anymore?
I'm a little bit different. I think in the dressing room is one thing, Clem, and I'm a big believer.
Yeah, this was publicly, you're right.
Yeah. I'm a big believer that dressing room is, you know, it's the inner sanctum, you know, between a manager and a player, or player to player. In my opinion and my experience, pretty much anything should be allowed to be said, and it doesn't come out of that environment. You always have another opportunity to speak to the lad maybe on the Monday or the Tuesday, and maybe expand on your point. But there are going to be flashpoints, there are going to be disappointments, and clearly the error, you know, has led to them not getting the result that they wanted. Again, my only issue with it would be, and again, I think of all these things because you do think, well, if I was the manager, what would I do in that situation? You know, you try and take all the good and the bad and, you know, apply it to yourself. And again, for me, being a young boy, I felt maybe the public side of things, you know, maybe not the most of helpful things for the boy himself. I think the terminology, again, I've got sympathy with Ian Everett because, again, my kind of era, our kind of era, it was a very commonly used phrase, you know, in terms of, you know, he's just trying to give the boy a G up. And of course, things have changed and you do have to be a lot more careful with it. I think the general gist of what he was trying to say is fair enough. You know, it's, you know, you're a young boy, you're from an academy, but this is real world stuff. This is a football match that we felt we should have won, and mistakes at the moment, you know, are costing them. And I think, again, as a manager, when you set your team up, you do all your prep, you do all your work, that is the most frustrating thing when an individual error leads to you not getting a result, because you feel, and I could see it in his voice, that, you know, everything else had been spot on. But again, that's part of the process. I'm not in that position yet to say how I definitely would have responded. And I get the frustration. And I'm sure, listen, it's something that he's a relatively young manager himself, and, you know, something he'll learn from, hopefully something, you know, the goalkeeper will learn from as well. And hopefully they can sort of move forward and get on with things.
Yeah, I think you've walked the line quite nicely there, given us some nice insights. I'm sure you'll be in for a beer after Saturday's game. Listen, Grandpa, we've taken enough of your time. Go and put your slippers on. Go and get some repeats of Only Fools and Horses and your dressing gown and sit on your sofa and have your little nap, and off you go. Mate, it's been an absolute delight. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Nice one, Clem. Thanks a lot for having me, mate.
That's it for another week. A huge thanks to Joby McEnough, to Ivor Heller and Luther Blissett. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and please tell everybody about us on your socials. If you want to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.